Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jeff Whittington, in today for Chris Boyd. You've probably seen the photos on social media, the bleak grocery store shelves emptied of products that wouldn't exist without bees. Bees are a crucial part of an amazing system that has worked for as long as we can remember. Plants need pollinators to reproduce, bees need pollen to feed their offspring and nectar to make honey, and us, well, we need the food that results from this little partnership, but we tend to get in the way. And as a result, bees and other pollinators are having a hard time. Development, climate change, industrial farming practices, and even the choices we make about what to grow in our yards are affecting the bees' habitat. And a world without healthy bee population is a world where an estimated 2/3 to 3/4, depending on who you ask, of our crops just wouldn't exist, especially things like squash, tomatoes, peppers, apples, pears, and nuts, and, oh, we'd lose most of the flowers, too. So how does it all work, and what can we do to keep bees and other pollinators happy and healthy? Well, we'll get answers to these questions and a lot more this hour with a panel of experts. Brandon Pollard's a Dallas-based beekeeper with the Texas Honeybee Guild. John Watts is entomologist at the Texas Discovery Gardens. And Ann Stein is a pollinator conservation specialist at the Xerces Society, who works with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Wonderful to be here.
So let's start with the basics. John, describe the honeybee for us.
A honeybee, of course, is an insect, and they are belong to the order Hymenoptera, which means that they have membranous wings. They're basically an offshoot of wasps that became vegetarians and vegans and collect pollen and nectar to produce what we call honey.
And hives has workers, drones, and a queen.
Indeed. There are three castes in a honeybee hive. The queen is, of course, the main one. She's the one that does all the reproduction. The workers are also female, but they do all the work. And drones are specifically for reproductive purposes and only produced at certain times of the year.
And the drones, I guess, are male, right?
They are male, yes. And unusual in that they have half the genes that the queens and workers have.
And there are thousands of different species of wild bees in the U.S. and Canada. What are some of the wild bees that we have around here in North Texas?
Well, we have the classic bumblebee. Most people are familiar with the bumblebee because they're huge and fuzzy and kind of cute. bumblebees are some of the few native bees that have a true social order. Like honeybees, they have drones, they have workers, they have queens. An interesting fact that most people don't know is that most native bees don't have a caste system at all. Your average native bee is a single mom provisioning her own nest. So it's a little different.
Yeah, the honeybees have thousands of bees in the hives, and the bumblebees just have a few hundred, right?
That's correct. A large to medium-sized bumblebee colony would have something in the neighborhood of 300 to 500 members as opposed to 50,000.
Brandon, what kind of bees do you work with primarily?
We work with Apis mellifera mellifera, which is the European honeybee.
And it's different, obviously, from the wild population. Is there ever any risk of the wild bees and the European bees? Do you have to worry about them interacting or getting in each other's way?
Not particularly. I mean, I think most beekeepers do pay attention to the genetics in their hives if they're paying attention to what's going on inside of the beehive. You're always selecting certain, if you're a queen breeder, for instance, you're selecting for certain traits depending on where you have your bees. You know, if it's cold climates, if it's warm climates. For us, we have to, because we are primarily urban, mm-hmm. we have to spend a lot of attention, make sure that we have very docile bees. You know, not necessarily that are just incredibly prolific honey producers per se, but it's really important for us to have bees that, you know, they can be in a community garden and we won't have, you know, any problems.
But you can have European honeybees and some are less aggressive than others?
Different subspecies do have a slightly difference in their temperament. Most of the bees that we have belong to one of two different subspecies, the Italian and the, what's the second one?
So there's Russian, Carniolan, Caucasian. But I'm not sure what some of the major groups are. Italians for sure are mm-hmm. some of the more popular bred species. But in the way of the different, people talk about the Africanized bees, for instance. That's mm-hmm. Apis mellifera scutellata, and those those bees you're going to find in Africa and South America. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, think about, oh, Africanized bees and killer bees and this, that, and the other. But the reality is that there's a lot of beekeepers in Africa and there's a lot of beekeepers in South America. And they just happen to know exactly what they're doing. It's just like we talk about when you, if you're working horses, you're going to work one horse totally different than you work another horse.
And what's the day in the life of a bee like?
Well, if we're talking about a native bee, mm-hmm. then she'll leave her nest. Another thing, most native bees are ground nesters, so she'll emerge from her burrow. She'll go out and collect nectar and pollen. Unlike honeybees, she doesn't tend to specialize. She'll tend to collect both at the same time. She'll return home. She'll provision a nest cell, maybe lay an egg on it, and go back and keep working. And, you know, they're diurnal, so she's going to be doing all of this while it's light outside.
So you said that they're not specialized. What does that mean?
I mean that she'll be collecting nectar and pollen in the same trip. Honeybees have this complex society where a worker might decide that today I'm going to go get pollen, or today I'm going to go get nectar. Your average native bee, some is a ground nester, as I said, and they don't have workers. So if she wants nectar, she's got to go get it. If she wants pollen, she's got to go get it.
And a hive bee, what's a hive bee's day like, Brandon?
Well, and like our Xerces friend was mentioning, it's so important to understand. If that's, E.O. Wilson does a lot of work with ants and mm-hmm. they're social insects, and it's a, you know, this fascinating idea of a superorganism. And that's why bees are so incredibly fascinating, because it's this super, super complex thing where you have thousands and thousands of insects in one, you know, confined space. But they all manage to figure it all out, and they all manage to get it all done. So say, for instance, we get a rain, and then that opens up a lot of blooms of the flowers, and there's this incredible influx of nectar that's you know, could be had by all. Well, what will happen is, in a beehive, is that maybe some of the bees that would be nurse bees inside of the beehive, that will be they will turn into foraging bees, and they'll turn into foraging bees because as the super organism that it is knows that it needs to get, you know, make hay while you can, and so they're gonna take some of the resources that would be feeding baby bees and actually use them as foragers to bring more food in to later on feed the babies.
John, you've got bees, you were telling me, at the Discovery Gardens now. How's that going?
Yes, we just got through putting an observational beehive in the butterfly house. The bees don't go into the butterfly house. They go outside to forage. But we're also going to have some information about bees and their importance.
And are people getting excited about it? Are they able to see kind of what's going on inside the hive?
Well, we have mixed reviews right now. Some people are scared because a lot of people have the impression that bees are aggressive and they're not. But other people are very interested in them, and they love to watch the bees go in and out and do their thing.
Are you going to harvest the honey when they make the honey?
I would hope that we just leave the honey in there, because that is what they use to get through the winter in the first place. It kind of depends on how much we get, I suppose.
We're talking about bees this hour on Think with a panel of experts. If you have questions or thoughts, you can call us at 800-933-5372. You can also email us at think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet. I'm at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. Let's talk about the fear thing a little bit, because people do tend to be afraid of bees. And what other than allergies, other than a specific allergy to bee sting, what do people really have to be afraid of?
Yeah, I mean, and we always, because we're educators and we do a lot of work with kids in schools and that sort of thing, it's important to get the kids early, because a lot of the times, you know, we're taught by either parents or teachers, you know, to be afraid of things. And from a common sense standpoint, I mean, bees die when they sting. So from an evolutionary standpoint, that's really not something. They're not just going out and looking for trouble. You know, they're not, you know, terrorist pollinators.
And if you stop and think about it, pretty much everything you see on the media about bees has them as just stinging you for no reason. And that's not the case. They only do that to protect their colony. Or if they, of course, if you grab one, they're going to protect themselves that way as well. But they're not aggressive to begin with.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that with what John's saying, I mean, a lot of the times we see them on the news and, you know, that's all the excitement and somebody got stomach and went to the hospital or expired. And, you know, oftentimes you'll find out that there's probably a weed eater or a lawnmower involved in there somewhere.
So this is something I bump up against a lot when I'm talking to people about installing pollinator habitat. And the way that I try and explain it is, if your average bee, she doesn't have any spares, she's not a worker. Your average bee is entirely responsible for her own reproductive effort. If she picks a fight with a person and dies, it's not like the colony continues. There is no colony. She is an entire unit. So your average bee is not going to pick a fight. Period.
Your average native bee.
Correct.
Because I think that it's, I really want to make it clear here that when we're talking about a honeybee colony, there's one queen that's giving birth to all of, laying all the eggs.
That's correct. Big mama.
And those are all daughters.
And
they
live
pretty much clones.
They live 2 or 3 years or so, right? The queens do, from what I've read.
3 to 5 on average.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, but the natives, they don't have the workers. They're just doing it all themselves.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
And they only live one season. They don't go past winter,
the natives, the honeybee. Okay.
Yes, the native bees.
Okay.
Right. That's another distinction about our bumblebees is, unlike honeybees, their colonies don't last 3 to 5 years. They last 1 year. So that's another important distinction.
So what does a bee need to thrive?
Well, they need a lot of what we need. They need food, good, clean food, a variety, in order to maintain their nutrition. They can't just do one type of pollen. They need, unless they're a specialist, most mm-hmm. of them need a variety of pollen. They need a home, so they need somewhere to nest or build their colony, and they need protection from pesticides.
And Brandon, what does a beekeeper need to thrive?
All those things times 10. I mean, that's exactly that. Just clean air, clean water, clean soil. And if we have those things, then they will have clean food. And then and in the way of us, I mean, we're down at the neighborhood markets and the farmers markets and things like that. And so we, you know, our livelihood is based on the honey production. So for us, if we can have healthy bees, then we can have good honey.
Well, give us a little snapshot of a day in the life of what you do with your bees.
Oh gosh, every day is so different. You know, it's wonderful to be sitting here in your studio today.
Well, you told me yesterday you were doing queen. You're doing work with queens.
Yeah,
so right?
What we do is, and because we have to pay very particular attention to genetics and that sort of thing, I mean, there's some people are a little bit more cavalier and they're, rescuing bees and putting them in places. You know, because we've been doing this for about a decade, you know, when we rescue bees, you have to pay particular attention because you don't necessarily know where that queen was mating. You don't know the certain drone population where she mated. And so because we have so many colonies that are proximal to humans, it's really important that we make sure that these rescued colonies have the right demeanor for us to be able to introduce them back into the city limits.
Well, I think, talk a little bit about the city limits, because you're not out in the pastures in the rural area. You're right here in town.
Correct.
You're placing hives in people's backyards.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Rooftops and community gardens, educational centers. I mean, all those places are so important just because we feel like those are, we had bees flying at the Discovery Gardens for a while before they had built a building. We had to move the bees. But having these colonies close to humans, like I said, it's really important for us to pay attention to the genetics. And so when I visited with you on the phone yesterday, you know, we pay $30, $35 for a queen that we know has been bred in a favorable environment. And that way, we will actually have proven colonies within the city limits that we will take bees and brood out of, make sure that we don't get mom. And then we can take those bees and brood and let them be without a mom for several, 24, 48 hours and introduce another mom. And that's how we make up for our losses from the winter.
We're talking about bees and pollinator health this hour on Think with Brandon Pollard, a beekeeper with Texas Honeybee Guild. We also have Ann Stein, who's with the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, and John Watts, entomologist at the Texas Discovery Gardens. You can join the conversation on the phone at 800-933-5372. You can email us at think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA in Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. I'm Jeff Whittington, in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about bees with Brandon Pollard, a beekeeper with the Texas Honeybee Guild, also John Watts, entomologist at the Texas Discovery Gardens, and Ann Stein, who's a pollinator conservation specialist at the Xerces Society, who works with the USDA. We're also taking your calls at 800-933-5372. You can email us you can email us at think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet. I'm at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. John, talk a little bit about what exactly is that bee doing when it lands on a flower?
Well, of course, the main reason it's going to the flower is to get the nectar and pollen for its food. But in the process, it's also pollinating flowers, cross-pollinating them. That's how plants reproduce. They can't move around like animals, so they get animals to help them out. So when a bee moves that pollen from flower to flower, the resulting pollination produces seeds. And if you stop and think about it, seeds are baby plants.
Well, and I was in my backyard the other day, and I've got some flowers, and I saw this bee, and it had these really bright orange, they look like knee pads or mm-hmm. sort of thigh guards.
Curbicula.
Curbicula.
I said to my wife, I said, look, that bee's got orange legs. This really happened. She said, that's pollen.
That's right. That's the pollen they've collected on very specialized structures. In the case of honeybees and bumblebees, it's on the hind legs. Other bees have it in different places, like leaf-cutting bees have it on the bottom of their abdomen. But that's where they store it as they transport it back to the hive or their colony that they need to go back to.
And they eat pollen. And
that's their
and
protein.
Feed it to
yeah,
their...
it's their meat and eggs and fish.
Okay. So,
mm-hmm. Or beans.
And it's something. And they also make honey. Why do they make? You said earlier they make honey to get through the winter, right?
Honey, of course, is basically just carbohydrates and sugar. That's their energy source. But that gets them through the winter, along with some of the pollen as well, I would assume.
Yeah, and it depends each species, and also depending on where you're keeping your bees. There's some species of bees, and just like John was mentioning, the Italians, you know, there's some species of bees that the queen will just totally shut down laying eggs during the wintertime. And then there's some species of bees where if the colony's strong enough and they can generate enough heat and there's enough protein and enough carbohydrates, then they will continue to produce bees through the wintertime if there's enough heat to be generated and food available.
So pollen is the protein source primarily for the larva, and so that's why they switch to honey more in the winter.
Okay. And they make other things too, though. They make we call it bee pollen, right? They make honey, but they make some other stuff, especially the honey.
Propolis comes to mind. Propolis is kind of the some people say it's the bee glue, but if you can go on any internet search engine and put in propolis, and there's all kinds of really incredible constituents to the propolis, but the propolis is essentially the bee's medicine.
They're resins from plants for the most part, and sometimes they're used to help seal cracks and crevices in the hive and everything so that the environmental conditions of rain and so forth can't get in.
Our phone number is 800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Tarek in Dallas. Hello, Tarek.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a first-time caller, and it's a wonderful program. Lately, I've been hearing a lot of buzz about the bees, so to speak, and it's almost down to a level of crisis. Sometimes I hear that frustration. So I was kind of wondering, what is it the general public can do? Is there anything we can do to encourage or make it more friendly environment for the bees? Anything we can do in our backyards for the kids? And I'd like to put a couple of beehives in my backyard for my nieces and nephews to come and enjoy that. Is that something that you would encourage or recommend?
I think we'll have a couple of answers for you.
Hey, Tarek. Right. So first and foremost, what I would say is plant wildflowers. There you're helping honeybees, you're helping native bees, and that would be huge. You could also go to your nursery if you buy plants and ask them if they're treating their plants to make sure that the plants haven't been treated with a pesticide that might harm bees when they were to nectar or pollen on it. And absolutely. Everybody can help your bees, your honeybees or your native bees, because bees live at such a scale where your backyard garden actually can make a difference. There are some native bees whose entire home range might be contained within an eighth of a mile. So just by planting wildflowers in your backyard, you can certainly help.
And to piggyback on what Ann was saying, and Tarek, thank you for calling in and being concerned and caring. I think there's a certain because there is a lot of buzz, there's also, there's a certain population of havers and not necessarily keepers. And that's one of the things that we do with the Texas Honeybee Guild is to try to kind of get people to understand that, you're not going to go to a social living or Groupon class in a half day and, go home and go to Amazon and, you know, get your bees over the internet, and then it's, you know, it's not one of these plug and play kind of things. So it's really important to be, you can consider yourself a beekeeper if you're actually planting forage. If you're planting native forage, then you're actually keeping bees. You know, not necessarily have them in a box, but bees, honeybees, they go 3 to 5 miles, you know, and some of the natives will have a much shorter foraging distance. But that's why it's so important for folks that they do make sure that they're planting natives, because you're also addressing the water issue. You don't have to water them as much.
And I read that if you let a little corner of your yard go kind of wild, or don't cut that corner,
sure,
you know, and kind of let it get built up, some of the native bees might actually use that as a nesting.
Exactly.
Area. Absolutely.
I mean, and they come back quickly too. They you know, they're just sitting there waiting to have the proper habitat come back into open up for them to come in and set up shop.
Right, like your bunch grasses, maybe a wood pile or a brush pile, that's heaven to a bumblebee. Or, you know, if you have a cane crop like blackberry and you don't cut it back, then these leafcutter bees or other tunnel nesting bees might put a little home in there. So there's a lot you can do just in your own yard.
How do bees know what to do? How do they know? Because they change roles, right? So they're born for a couple of days, they nurse other young, and then they clean, and then they act as ventilators in the hive. And how do they know? How do they know what to do? Do we have any way of knowing what a bee is thinking?
Gosh.
Well, being a beekeeper, and I'm not as degreed as Anne and John. It's so wonderful to be.
Probably knows more about that. Though.
Well, it's wonderful to be nestled between two butterfly lovers, but for, you know, just kind of like a general idea would be age. You know, if the bee, you know, there's a certain time in a honeybee's life where their glands, which the wax glands on their abdomen, will be producing, you know, the wax. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a teenager has, you know, oily skin. You know, the bees at a certain time of their life will be able to produce that wax, and, you know, they make their house right off their belly. So, you know, when the bees are born, it's in them. They immediately start cleaning. It'd be nice. I'm sure a lot of moms out there would love it if their kids did that.
Yeah, a lot of their different roles actually go from being strictly inside the hive to starting to go toward the outside, where they become the ones that fan to keep the air conditioning inside the hive going, and they just basically do a little bit at a time to get further and further out to become foragers eventually.
Yeah, and with some of our sponsors, you know, sometimes it'll be like the first year that we'll have bees in a location, and the person that's appreciating those bees will call and say, "God, you know, the brand, I think the bees are swarming. They're swarming." And I'll say, "Well, you know, do they look like, you know, it's probably in late afternoon, and there's like these like really circular flight patterns going out in front of the hive, and it looks like the bees are just boiling out of the hive. But actually, what's happening is that there's that next generation of foragers that are taking their flight lessons."
And we got an email here from, this is from Joey in Denton, who wants to know if the guest would explain the bee dance that is used to present a suitable food source or new location for the colony. How does that work?
So Von Frisch was the one that actually discovered the bee waggle dance. And actually, if I didn't have so many neurotoxins, I'd remember from my Nebraska master beekeeping class that we actually learned how to do that, and I've since forgotten how to do it. But basically,
well, it's radio, so
okay.
We can't see. We can't
Thank
see you.
You. Okay. yeah, that you can with wings and antenna at the market for later. But the idea, the bees use the sun and the location of the hive and whatever they're foraging for, whether it's propolis or pollen or water, they use those three points. And that bee waggle dance is using those three points. And so a foraging bee can go out, and this also goes for when they're swarming as well. But a foraging bee will go out from a colony, and it will let the bees inside the hive know where to go exactly based on, you know, the points of the sun.
And the amount of waggle,
right,
too, tells you the distance. And
that's
everything.
Right. So if it's like a really, like, you know, there's some pollen that has more protein than others. So honeybees, you know, they'll get a whole lot more excited about pollen that has more protein. And so the bee, you can actually see that when they're waggling inside the hive, is that you can really tell when there's something really good out there.
So farmers rely on bees, too. It's become kind of this big agricultural industry, really, moving these beehives all over the country. Brandon, do you take hives to farmers?
Well, we're a guild, so we understand that it's kind of a necessary evil. I mean, you know, if we're not putting 400 to 500 colonies on a flatbed truck and taking them from Florida to California just to pollinate one crop, then, you know, there's 80% or 90% of the world's almonds comes from California. Mm-hmm. And sadly, that's actually, you know, beekeepers and people can make money doing that. You know, to think that you can take a flatbed truck full of bees from Pennsylvania or Florida, take them to California from February 15th to March 15th and make money doing that. But that's why it's so, so important. And that's why the honeybees, and also what we're working towards is to try to get some of these farms that are on an incredibly large scale. And the Xerces Society is helping out wonderfully with this, is to try to plant instead of just, you know, glyphosating all of the foliage, we can actually maybe think about planting some of these things that are, you know, maybe food for some of the natives that are in these particular places where some of these other large crops are growing. Because what's the data showing is that where you have crops where there's also forage for native bees, then you will have more food production.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about that, because the farming, the scale of the farming and turning what used to be meadows and fields and even some remnant forest into just monoculture is part of the issue, right?
Right. That's absolutely right. As I was talking earlier about how your backyard garden can make a difference, bees are a local resource. So if you put the habitat on the ground around where you want them to be, you will have a healthier population of native bees. In California, we've done a lot of work with vineyards. We're starting to work with almond growers, where you plant like a pollinator border or a pollinator hedge, and then you draw in these native pollinators that can help take some of the burden off the honeybees. And so that's the whole idea.
Well, this has become kind of a big story. And I mean, even the White House has gotten involved. And I read that the White House has established a pollinator health task force back in May with goals for reducing honeybee colony losses during the winter to no more than 15% within 10 years, increasing the eastern population of the monarch butterfly to 225 million butterflies in their overwintering grounds in Mexico by 2020. Are these reasonable goals, or is there something that, because this is, it's not just one thing, right, that's causing the bee decline?
Well, and that's why it's wonderful to be here, and, you know, thank you for the opportunity to talk about it so people like Tarek can call in and say, what can I do in my backyard? And that's really what it's going to take, is everybody in their backyard planting more forage. You know, it's easy to get lost in the numbers when you're just talking about, you know, industrial agriculture. But there's quite a few things that people can do in their yards and in their neighborhoods and in their municipalities that can help protect these species. I mean, John was just mentioning about the monarch migration. I mean, the monarchs come through here because there's a lot of milkweed, but you can never have enough milkweed. So, you know, we would love to encourage, you know, places like the, you know, and the Discovery Gardens is just this huge buffet for pollinators, and to create all of these little interstate buffets, if you will, of food for these species, you know, for to give them the ability to get from one place to the other and just to, you know, survive, you know, in their little solitary spaces.
I guess you have to really also drill into people that they wouldn't have apples, they wouldn't have peaches, they wouldn't have pears or cucumbers or tomatoes if we didn't have bees.
Yeah, and I'm glad, and it's true. I mean, honeybees are experiencing toxic stress. That's what the honeybees are experiencing, and we need to take some of that load off of the honeybees because we rely so heavily on the honeybees for pollination. But one of the reasons why we do is because of monoing or monoculture. You know, you can say you're healthy and eat bananas for 30 days and then eat cranberries for 30 days and eat blueberries for 30 days. But if you do that, you're going to have some sort of vitamin and mineral deficiency, and that's what's helping or hurting the species of bees, native or European, is that they have a very limited diet.
And that's what you're describing with the flatbed truck and the 400 hives. They're going to an almond grove for 3 weeks. Then they're going to whatever's next.
Cranberries, blueberries, watermelon, squash, you know, any of those plants. You know, I think there's over between 90 and 100 of them that need to be pollinated by some insect.
These flatbed trucks are kind of a substitution for the habitat you might have on the ground, which could support your bees year-round. You know, if you have just nothing but almonds for acres and acres and acres, you're not going to have a ton of bees, especially if you're nuking it with chemicals every time, you know, pretty regularly. So by trucking in the bees, they're kind of circumventing this having habitat on their orchard.
Yeah, and that's one of the major issues. If you talk to the, you know, the beekeeping industry, I mean, I'm just looking, we're members of the American Honey Producers Association and of the American Beekeeping Federation, and you talk to a lot of the commercial beekeepers, and, you know, pesticide, prophylactic pesticide use is a very serious problem.
And it's not just insecticides, it's the herbicides, too, that are put out there. You know, without those plants growing into the orchards that are also other sources of pollen and nectar, they're just basically stuck on a, I hate to use the term fast food diet, but it's kind of like that.
And that's one of the things with why the system is somewhat broken and why we love folks like the Xerces Society, because you're talking about more diversified species of plant material that's going to provide many more diversified sources of protein and nectar and pollen and vitamins and minerals. But I was going to say that just in this publication, it's a Pollinator Stewardship Council, and it's a wonderful website. I think it's pollinatorstewardship.org. It's Michelle Colopy. But she's got an article in this American Honey Producers Association publication that just came out last month, and it says here the prophylactic use of pesticides, including herbicides, as John said, may attack the 5% of the pest insect, but it is wiping out the 95% of beneficial insects.
And it's just the nature of the beast that the pest insects come back first. So it's a vicious cycle, and it's unfortunate.
So it's all these – it's the herbicides, the pesticides, and the fungicides that are all – you know, it's – and that's why, you know, people say, what is colony collapse disorder? Well, if you – you have the varroa mite, and then you have, you know, one particular agrochemical that's used. And some of the studies that, you know, show that the mortality and the rate can be thousandfold if those two things are in the hive at just one time.
Well, we'll get into that after we take a quick break. We're talking this hour with Brandon Pollard, Ann Stein, and John Watts. And we're talking about bees and pollinator protection. You can call us at 800-933-5372. You can email us at think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA in Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. I'm Jeff Whittington. Our phone number is 800-933-5372. Email address think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. We're talking this hour with Brandon Pollard, Ann Stein, and John Watts about bees. And don't worry, I'm just sitting in for Chris Boyd today. She'll be back at the end of her vacation. But we'd love to hear from you, and let's go to the phones right now and talk to Carrie, who's calling from Arlington. Hello, Carrie.
All right. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Your show came at a perfect time, because I have a pollinator garden in my front and backyard. I got butterflies, bees, everything, Texas native plants. But the city of Arlington is spraying tonight. What can I do to protect my pollinators in my backyard?
Anyone?
Well, we've been working on this issue quite a bit, especially since the major onset of West Nile when we got hit in Dallas County in 2012. Some of the things, and I'm not sure, I'm not terribly familiar with Arlington. I know there are some municipalities that you can actually get on a no-spray list if you have chemical sensitivities or you're concerned about your pollinators or your fish pond or your pets. There are some municipalities that if you call, I'm not sure what department it is in Arlington, but I know with City of Dallas, it's the Code Compliance Department. But you can call them, and at least what the City of Dallas has done in years past, I'm not sure how current this is with the City of Dallas, but you can call a certain city department in Arlington and get on the no spray list. And what at least the city of Dallas told us is that they'll turn the truck off the house before and the house after the house that requests not to be sprayed.
I would recommend covering your pollinator garden if you can. While bees are active during the day, and so they might not be hit by the initial blast, I think that we were discussing earlier, and most mosquito sprays are pyrethroids, which are toxic for 24 hours. So if you could cover your flowering plants, I would do so.
Now, Brandon, you told me that the city of Dallas has started a conversation about pollinators and is looking to figure out a way to balance the pollinator protection with protecting the public from Nile and chikungunya and these mosquito-borne diseases. And I know there's an outreach component, and there's actually even a meeting.
Yeah.
There's a meeting scheduled for Tuesday.
Yes,
at the
please
Oakland
come.
United Methodist Church.
Yes, at 6:30. And we're there. You know, it's really wonderful to, you know, over the years of us, you know, the decade-long we've been doing this here in Dallas, it's really been wonderful to not just go down to the county commissioner's court or the council meetings and just, you know, complain for 3 minutes. You know, we really like to have input, you know, which is so refreshing to have your listeners making the connection, you know, that they're understanding that we need to protect the pollinators, we need to protect humans as well. But that's why we're excited to work with the city, hoping that we can, you know, work with Strategic Customer Service, with the Parks Department, and with the Office of Environmental Quality and the Co-Compliance Department to try to really wrap around this issue of how do we protect the public. And one of the ways that we see we can do it is with larvicide and not using adulticides. If you're actually using larvicide, we're looking at some of these liquid BTI products, Bacillus thuringiensis israelanus, in a liquid form where that can be sprayed out of the trucks instead of the adulticide. And what that'll do is it's more proactive because you know, the Dallas County says fight the bite, and we say fight the bite before they take flight, which means that we're using larvicides and not adulticides.
Well, what do y'all do at the Texas Discovery Gardens when the spraying is happening, or when you don't, you know, you want to have lots of insects, but you don't want to have mosquitoes?
Well, we do let them know that we don't want to be sprayed whenever they do the aerial sprayings, but all the standing water we have at the gardens have natural enemies of mosquitoes in there in the first place. Gambusia, which are called mosquito fish, are one of the major ones. Dragonflies and damselflies are quite common there in the garden too. And all three of those live in the water during the time when the larvae of the mosquitoes are in there. So they actually keep the populations down considerably.
And what do y'all do at home? Because this whole mosquito thing is really, as you said, you got to start so that you don't have to spray an adulticide to kill all the insects aimed at one specific pest. What do you do at home to kind of keep it from
doing that? I was really happy to hear Tark calling in, and that's one of the things. I mean, if you want to be a native pollinator keeper, well, you're going to make sure that you're paying particular attention of the standing water that's in and around your yard. You know, we'd like to get it where neighborhood associations, church groups, you know, some of these entities can go throughout a neighborhood and address some of these standing water issues. And that's one of the things that I was excited to hear, that through the Office of Environmental Quality, that you can go to 311 and the Office of Environmental Quality is setting up a mechanism where citizenry can take a picture of stagnant water and send it into the city. You know, because that could potentially be a problem spot. Yep. You know, as far as
one of the larger issues, I think, is garbage that gets thrown away. Any of the plastic and styrofoam cups and so forth that go out, if they just end up where they can handle any bit of amount of water in them, that's enough for the mosquitoes to develop in. So trying to keep trash from building up is another way. Also, if I'm not mistaken, you can also get from the city mosquito dunks, which are the BT inside of a substrate that you it's like a donut that floats in the water and releases the BT spores.
Study after study shows that these personal accountability things, like making sure that your yard doesn't have standing water, wearing long sleeves at dusk in the evening, and wearing insect repellent, these are far more effective than adulticides at preventing the spread of West Nile. Adulticides are actually very temporary, like you might be back to where you were before in a matter of weeks. Larvicides and personal accountability, that's what we recommend as control.
Thank you for that, Anne. And that was one of the things that we were talking about with the county and the city in years past addressing this issue is, you know, that, you know, mosquitoes have a fortnight birthright. You know, you can knock down every mosquito in the city, but guess what? In 2 weeks, if you're not addressing the larva, then you're back to the same spot again. So that's why it's so important with the personal accountability and recognizing the standing water and making sure that you're not watering your lawn. You know, if you have your St. Augustine, make sure that you're not watering that stuff right after you have a big rain.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Javier in Dallas. Hello, Javier.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm calling because in the back of my house, I have a very old tree. It has a colony of bees, and I don't really want to kill them. I want them to be removed safely because I need to cut the tree. And I have a lot of people calling to tell me things to spray the bees with, but I don't want to do that. I want to save them and transfer them somewhere else. Is there some company or organization that this is?
So part of what we've been doing over the 10 years of us doing this is, you know, getting people that have bees to the people that need bees. You know, that's actually one of the things, if the gentleman from the Parks Department with the City of Dallas is listening to this program, he's wondering why I'm not calling him at the moment. But there's several bee trees in a lot of parks around the City of Dallas, and people are like, well, what do we do with these bee trees? I mean, before we humans started putting them in boxes, bees lived in trees.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a very natural place for them to be. It's the whole Winnie the Pooh story. And so there is such a thing called a trap out, where you actually put a bee box on the outside of the tree where they're coming in and out. And sometimes this is not quite feasible if it is in fact in a park, you know, right next to a jungle gym, if, you know, and it's right by the ground, or if it's 30 feet up in the knot hole and it's in the limb or the trunk. Some of these situations aren't feasible, but a trap out is possible, where you can put a bee box right in the entrance where you're forcing those bees to go through that box. And this is also an issue. You have to think about the season you're doing it, because you can't really do it in November when the bees are clustered and trying to get through the wintertime. You want to do it when they're expanding, and they can expand into that box. And what will happen is the queen will start laying eggs in the box, and then you can detach the box from the tree. So it's quite a long process. So it's not, you know, a quick fix, but that's a non-toxic way of getting the bees out of places where they're not appreciated.
And this is one of the most popular kinds of questions on the Friday show that I do, where people, the Anything You Ever Wanted to Know show. Who do you call when you have bees in a shed or in your house?
And this is, you know, there are very, very few people that do this kind of work. I mean, from a pest control standpoint, I mean, you know, there are, you know, there are companies that will, you know, do it quote unquote safely, but, you know, sadly, they'll just put them in a black plastic bag and send them to the dumpster. You know, what we need to do is get, you know, beekeepers. You can sometimes go to your bee clubs. You know, there's the Trinity Valley Bee Club here in Dallas. There's the Collin County Hobby Beekeepers Association. You can go to northtexasbeekeepers.org. There's Metro Beekeepers out in Fort Worth. There's some of these places, you know, where there may be a retired person or somebody that maybe has a 9-to-5 but might be able to come on the weekends. I mean, I wish that we could rescue as many bees as we're losing, but, you know, at the moment, you know, we can't rescue them fast enough because we're losing them.
So Javier should give a call to one of those organizations.
One of the bee clubs. I mean, he could go through the Texas Honeybee Guild Facebook page, because we do kind of, you know, we hook up with some of these other clubs, and, you know, we all basically just try to get some of these issues addressed, because, I mean, at the end of the day, it is a fragile natural resource. And, you know, there's a lot of colonies that get into the darndest places, and sadly they're being exterminated. But we do need to think about trying to get the mechanism in place where we can actually take these colonies that aren't in places that are quite favorable and put them into a place that needs pollination.
And what is the Varroa destructor mite?
Right. So the Varroa destructor mite is, I believe it's native to East Asia. And it first showed up in the United States in the early 80s. And when it came through, it essentially wiped out the feral bee population. It's still a huge problem. I believe I've heard that in untreated hives, Varroa mites can take them out in 3 years. But what they do is Varroa mites suck bee blood or hemolymph. So they're like ticks, but they're like ticks that are the size of a dinner plate and are on your babies, because they feed on larvae as they're developing. And then while they do this, like ticks, they transmit diseases. So there are viruses that have hugely increased in prevalence since the arrival of the Varroa mite. In particular, I'm thinking deformed wing virus, among others. So it both weakens the hive in its own right, but then it also increases the pathogen load.
And it's just one more stressor that
it's another stressor. It's a vector, and that's what the comments that I was making before is, you know, you can have this, you can have the varroa present, and then just one of the many different agrochemicals present at the same time, and then the mortality is multiplied a ridiculous amount. And so that, you know, the mite is a serious issue. I think beekeepers that are doing things on a smaller scale that aren't necessarily on a lot of these pollination circuits don't necessarily – we don't have as many mite problems really because we have bees in places where there's fewer populations of bees, and we keep them in one place all year round where there's, you know, ideally less stress. But, you know, a beekeeper that says they don't have mites is probably lying. It's, you know, bees are always managing the mite populations.
So we're getting surprisingly close to the end of the hour, and I would like to go around and just get everybody, you know, what is one or two things that people can do, maybe even starting this weekend, to increase, you know, to prop up our pollinators, bees, butterflies, other pollinators. What's a couple of
wildflowers? Definitely wildflowers, and they're not only beautiful, but again, they are what the pollinators need. They don't require as much water, so they're easier to handle as far as your water utility bills go. And, yeah, wildflowers.
You don't have to mow them either, right?
You don't have to mow them until after they've seeded.
Brandon?
Well, our friend Ricky Lennox, who works with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and this is kind of to piggyback on what John was mentioning, but this book here called Range Plants of North Central Texas. But I know we have a lot of roads and maybe lots of ideas of more roads, but the thing that's under the roads is these wonderful native plants. And so in the way of wildflowers, it's the native plant species that really will carry us through, because not only will the honeybees be able to take advantage of that, but you're also giving the native bees that are just so important the opportunity to survive and thrive in an urban area that doesn't have particularly very much forage.
So do some research, put some native plants.
Yeah, there's the Native Plant Society of Texas. Mm-hmm. That's a good resource. The Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center is a really great resource. But it's really important to know your bioregion, you know your bioregion, because the soil order is going to determine the plant material. And you want to make sure that if you're trying to propagate a certain type of plant species, you want to make sure that you're putting it in the right soil.
Anne?
That's right. I also want to say wildflowers, not just because they feed bees, but also because wildflowers are the host plants for most of our beautiful butterflies. So wildflowers, and ask your nursery if they've treated their plants before you plant them.
Yeah, the systemic pesticide issue is a real problem. So just, you know, make sure that if you are going to be putting a seed in the ground, that it's not pre-treated with something that's going to get into the plant itself. And apart from also just the wildflowers, we also want to talk about things that are edible. You know, things that you can make into tea. Some of these things, I mean, plant a garden that you can, you know, have time with your kids and your family.
Yeah, tomato plants, right?
Tomato plants are popular with bees. It's things that bloom and
tomato
that you can eat.
Tomato plants are popular with native bees, I will say.
Yeah, and bumblebees actually they're a much better pollinator of tomatoes than honeybees because they sonicate. They vibrate the whole plant.
Well, we could go on, and maybe we will at a future time. Brandon Pollard, beekeeper with the Texas Honeybee Guild. Anne Stein, a pollinator conservation specialist at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And John Watts, entomologist at the Texas Discovery Gardens. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we put links to all of your organizations up on the Think page at kera.org/think. The show is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is our associate producer. You can find me on Twitter, at Jeff Whittington on Twitter, and reach out to us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Jeff Whittington. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.